Alan Kring Productions, in association with Emergent Life Studio, presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240 for Autumn Semester 2021. Today, Introduction to Finance podcast. Got to sound professional. This is where I reiterate some of the fundamental differences between finance and accounting. But I also go into other aspects too, because I'm always trying to interest you in finance as a possible major or minor. Now, I know for most of you, that is just like, no, I'm not doing that, you fool. But at the same time, in a way, we do rule the world in dark and good ways. So when I say in a joking reference, come to the dark side, we have cookies, I'm referring, of course, to the Death Star and Darth Vader, and we do need new crew for our new Death Stars, I mean, because those rebels wiped out a lot of crew members, and some of them were good friends of mine. But I'm going to show you how far and wide finance goes. It's expansive. And I'm one of those professors, if you're going to go into higher finance, you'll see me teaching a lot of courses, a lot of different courses. Next semester, I'll be teaching derivatives and international corporate finance. So that's only some of the aspects. I'll get into that here in just a little while. But let me emphasize something right off the bat. The most fundamental difference between finance and accounting is, of course, involves the cost, what we consider a cost versus what sane people think of as a cost. We look at replacement cost. We look at opportunity cost. We look at future expected cost, because the past is gone for us. It's just not there. And yeah, with respect to people, we can look at the past as a guide to future behaviors. Of course we can. But at the same time, with respect to finance, stocks, bonds, things like that, it doesn't work that way. They obey these laws of the universe that take the past and put everything that's worth information in its current state so that you can't tell anything by looking at the past. If you've ever seen one of those, you might have seen one of those chess players who can play a whole row of chess games at the same time. Well, man, they must be memorizing a lot. No, they're not. Because everything about the best next move is where the board is now. So they don't have to remember anything about any of those players, what they did. They just look at the board, and that is telling them what their next move is. The past is already captured in a snapshot of the board right now. That's what happens with stock prices. The price now already has everything about what happened in it. That's a difficult concept because we want to say past is prologue. The past means something. We can look at that data, those charts and all that, and it can say, well, what should we do next? It's really hard when you don't have that. When it's all in what your training has been and where we are now is what you do next. I think the first time I saw that was in military training. It was like, it was a situation, as they said, on the ground. In other words, stop thinking about what got you here. We can talk about that later. But right now, you have to deal with the situation here. Use your knowledge of what this situation tells you is going to happen next to decide on your next move. From here. And so, when I show you the screens, you have to know that we're looking at physics. This is not magic. It's not religion. It's not opinion. It is what it is. I can be pissed off all I want about losing a lot of money today, but it doesn't matter, because all that matters is what I'm going to do next. I learned my lesson. I put myself out too far in my exposure. I didn't diversify my portfolio. Yada, yada, yada. Okay, good. Lessons learned. Now, let's see what happens tomorrow, and I will decide how to attack at that point. Well, let me show you the screens, and we're going to look at it as we always do. Will you quit barking at me about that, you fool? It just irritates the hell. Oh, sorry. I argue with computers. It's sort of like arguing with my cats. They don't care. Okay, finance.yahoo.com. And again, I'm going to just throw terminology at you, talk to you, and no, I don't want you. If you remember everything I say from day to day, I'm going to say, you're weird, man. Because I expect it to be a build-up through time of knowledge. The S&P 500 and the Dow 30 are not exchanges. They are just theoretical portfolios. I mean, you could actually build this portfolio if you had enough money, but actually, there are now these instruments, securities, that you can buy that are actually the portfolio itself. Like there's an ETF, an electronically traded fund called SPDR. And SPDR is the S&P 500. In other words, there's a company that buys the S&P 500, all of them, in their right proportions, and then you buy a stock in that corporation. So you are buying the S&P 500. It does exactly what the S&P 500 does. So that way, you can actually play these markets, if you want. And there's obviously for the Dow. But notice that, okay, now, the NASDAQ is an actual exchange. It's that electronic exchange. The NASDAQ is like the New York Stock Exchange, the American Stock Exchange. I mean, there are these regional exchanges, the Philly Exchange and all this. And then there are exchanges all over the world. The FTSE out of London, the Nikkei out of Japan, the Han or the Hang out of China. Just everywhere exchanges exist. And there are portfolios like that. For example, London's exchange is captured when we look at a portfolio called the FTSE, which is 100 big companies in there. The Nikkei is a massive exchange, and we look at the Nikkei 225. It's sort of like 225 sample stocks. And I'll show you that here in a minute. But know this, that these numbers that I'm looking at, again, remember that the actual values mean nothing. I don't give a rat's butt if the Dow, well, the Dow fell 248 points today. My God, that's bad. No, that's just what happened. That's only 0.70%. Yeah, that's noticeable. I mean, like I said, a quarter of a percent to a third of a percent. I'd start getting excited when it's more than that, up or down. And here, it's enough that got my attention a little bit. But I'm not going to go crazy. 0.70%. Okay, great. Now, the S&P 500 slipped too. Not quite as much, 0.68%. And the NASDAQ slipped even less. 0.44%. You see the pattern? The biggest got kicked in the clock the hardest. Then 500 big ones, including some that are small, a lot that are smaller than the Dow 30, they got kicked. Wait, will you stay still? Oh, I keep forgetting that. Oh, that's right. It's still trading. We're still in the trading day. Yeah, we got 24 minutes left before the dinner bell. Okay, so they're going to be fluctuating around. I'm going to be chasing them down here. But notice that the NASDAQ got hit, but not as hard. So whatever news was motivating the market, it seems to have been worse for big, big companies. It was bad for small companies, but it wasn't as bad. You can get a sense of what the market sentiment is through this. Now, let me show you, go inside of the S&P 500. Now, this would be a ginormous portfolio, extremely expensive. You want to buy into the S&P 500? Well, you're going to start with $4,417.20, cupcake, and that's just to get started. You're going to have margin requirements. Now, look at this. First things first, last night at the closing bell, the Dow, the S&P 500 was at 4448 and change. Now, this morning it opened at 440.94. So, in other words, The overnight action, the post-market and the pre-market, was negative. There was some sell-off pressure on orders going into the entries this morning. So in other words, it opened, dropped from where it closed last night. So you've got to be careful about that because you can't play too much in those markets. So you could end up, well, fortunately, 4448.08. And then you wake up and the bell opens. Wait a minute, 4440, what the heck happened there? Well, that was overnight pressure and it was sell pressure. If it falls, that would mean that the balance of orders was more sells than buys. If it rose, that would mean that the balance of orders was more buys than sells. Now, the day's range, it swung through an actual, that's actually a very tight range. You see that range from 44.1607 to 44.5432? If I were to look at that, that was probably the low for the day. That was about the 44.1607. See there? The trough there today. And then you come up here, that was probably early on. Do you notice how there was a rally at the bell that pushed it up? Rally means that there's buying pressure, okay? The bulls are outnumbering the bears. Now, a bull is optimistic, a buyer. If you hear, that's a bull, okay? A bear is pessimistic, is a seller. The world is always dark and ugly. Ugh, I hate the world. Now, as you can see, the bulls were in charge there at the opening. They said, okay, we're going to buy, buy, buy. And they pushed the price up, but then the bear said, oh, no, you don't. And they smacked the crap down a little bit. But notice that that was actually a pretty big up and down fight. It was like buy, sell, ebb, flow, like tides. There really wasn't a huge direction until there was some action there in the afternoon. The bulls did a spike, and then the bears apparently came in and short sold the hell out of it. And then the bulls came back. So every day is like this. This is your economics course, microeconomics. Made real. The equilibrium price, where the quantity supplied equals the quantity is cleared by the quantity being demanded. This is the real world of it, happening second to second. Day in, day out, across the world, the clocking of it. And this is not small amounts of money. This is trillions and trillions of dollars, to the point now where we have days that are quadrillions of dollars. Sir, what are you worth? Yes, what are you worth? Now, estimate, what would your mom say you're worth?
I don't even know, honestly.
I don't either, because my mom's dead. Well, awkward, wasn't that? You understand what I'm saying, though, is that we in this room, and I'm going to show you this in a very real way, we are so trivial that we are meaningless. And I hate to say that because it applies to me as much as it does to you. We are those tiny particles. We think about the Earth. It's such a vast, wonderful place. And then you look at one column of stardust being lit by stars, and it is taller than anything that even going at the speed of light you could cover in 10 lifetimes. I'll show you one company, MSFT, Microsoft. You see this number right here? That market cap means that's the total number of shares outstanding times the price of each share. That is the total value of the equity of Microsoft. In other words, the ownership of Microsoft is $2.198 trillion. That's more than all of us in this room will make in 10 lifetimes. Oh, well, hundreds and hundreds. You could add up all of the people of the world, what their value is, the present value of their future expected cash flows, and you would not get the value of the 100 largest corporations in the world. That's how serious it is out there. You think, well, we can affect the future. We are the future. We're ready to go. Oh, bring it, cupcakes. We're dead meat compared to these ginormous T-Rexes. But you always have to keep this in mind. The dinosaurs ruled until they didn't. What survived? Those tiny little smelly mammals scurrying around on the ground, eating their eggs and crawling underground when the asteroid blasted in and caused the climate to change so much that one time. So you keep that in mind. Don't despair completely, but do know that these are monsters. They are enormous beyond any comprehension. And even accounting does not take this seriously. Because let me show you something interesting. This is the market's estimate of total shareholder equity. Now let me show you, and I will do this over and over again, and I'm just going to get to the point where you're comfortable with these things that I do. Oh, will you quit doing that, for heaven's sakes? We're going to go over and look at its financial statements on Form 10-K. Well, this is, geez, that was just a few days ago. This is cool. Okay, so what I'm going to do here is I'm going to look at the balance sheet. Now, here's what the accounting version of the total shareholders' equity is. $141.988 billion. Now, here's what the market says the value of the equity is. $202.198 trillion. So which do you think matters? What the accountants say, $141.988 billion, or what the market says, $2.198 trillion. They're saying the same number, except it's not the same. Talk to me. Who's right? Oh, well, let me start it this way. Sir, you want to buy stock in Microsoft? Would you buy it from an accountant or would you buy it from a market broker? Yes. Yes, you would. If you wanted to take over, you, madam, if you wanted to take over Microsoft, you're one of those evil corporate raiders, are you going to say, well, the accounting value is $141 billion, so that's what I'm going to buy it for? Or would you pay what the market cap says it is, what the market says it is? Because you're going to have to buy the stock of that corporation to do it. So who's going to, which one number is relevant? Yes, the market cap is relevant. It's okay, you don't have to yell, but you know, before, market cap, don't you know that? You're the professor. But you understand what I'm saying here is that the market is where we live our lives. We don't live in a theoretical world, a lot of it. We live in, I do apologize to some extent for giving you so many references to the history of warfare and all of that, but empires are not created through great oratory and poems and pretty buildings. They are made through the fire and shrapnel on the ground level of combat and domination and control. And if you want that for Microsoft, you're going to pay attention to the $2.198 trillion. The accountants do what they have to do. Don't get me wrong. I greatly respect people who can live their lives doing accounting. Me, I'd kill myself. But that's just me. But you understand what I'm saying, though, is that what is relevant in finance is free cash flow. You work for a great corporation. They have made a huge profit last quarter, but they say, well, we don't have any money in our checking account to pay you this week. Our bad, but you're still working for a great company. What are you going to say? Yeah, so like, bite me, goodbye, I'm out of here. See, that's the point that I'm making here is that our lives are driven by free cash flow. not by profit. And if you look at free cash flow, that is telling you the story of intrinsic value. Intrinsic value is the underlying long-term value of a corporation. Intrinsic value is the underlying long-term value of a corporation. Intrinsic value is the long-run underlying value of a corporation. It is the enduring part. It is where we come in as the leaders of the free world. And this is where we have to live a life that is different from people in other countries. The more honest we are, and the less that we take stylized statements as being our directions for action, the less we lie to ourselves and look at underlying truth, the stronger we are in the world's competitive economies. We are getting our asses kicked around the world by China, by other countries that are strong, Japan, Russia to some extent, Saudis and others. And that's okay, because that's going to do something to us. It's going to make us strong. And how do we get strong? We don't lie to ourselves like others do. We're honest about our financials, about our companies, about our strengths and our weaknesses, and our opportunities and our threats. And this sounds like I'm preaching to you, and by golly, I am preaching to you, because this is the truth of the matter, is that the more we pay attention to what the market is telling us, the less we cry about how we were treated at yesterday when we did our investments, and the more we think about, what do I do now? I get up and I say, go again. Then we are in the game. And quite honestly, that's our strength. It hurts like hell to be truthful about things. And you also have to ignore, sometimes free cash flow can tell you stories that you're just sitting there, wait, this isn't what I'm seeing in the news. Is there a conspiracy? Blah. No, not really. The news cycle is driven by short-term excitement. It is not driven by the long. Because the long is not an interesting story. And oftentimes this long, it sounds kind of terrible. It's depressing to think about the future, but sometimes it's also very cool to think about the future. In your lifetimes, you're going to be seeing mining on asteroids. Yes, you're going to see teleportation. It won't be big things, but within your lifetimes, you'll see Borging, modular chips that can go into people's heads. You'll see that in your lifetimes. And you'll see faster than light travel. And we will see pictures of other alien planetary systems in your lifetimes. So the future's worth hanging around, even though some of it's going to really suck. But that's your problem. I'll be dead. Anyway, enough of that. Look. The previous close, in other words, that same thing. Last night, Microsoft closed at $292.52 per share. It opened up this morning, and you noticed that it was virtually the same. So there might have been buying and selling in the overnight and the pre, but it wasn't. It was pretty balanced, bears versus bulls in the overnight and the pre. Now, here's the next thing, bid and ask. The bid is what you are going to sell at. The ask is what you're going to buy at. You notice that that is a very tight bid-ask spread with the sizes virtually equal there. So when you think, well, I'm going to sell it because I see that number up there at the top. No, what you're going to sell it at, if you've got something you want to sell it, you're going to sell it at a price lower than what you would buy it at. Now, the more active the market is, the tighter that spread can be. But my God, I mean, it's just like there have been times when I was trading and bid-ask spreads were the difference between making a decent buck and taking my lesson with a paddling. So keep in mind, bid is what you sell at, ask is what you buy at. Bid is lower than ask. Although once in a while you'll see something weird. I don't know what happens. But the day's range. You notice that that was a really tight range. You see that? I mean, it's just like you had $4 swing in a stock that was nearly a $300 stock. Whoop-tee-doo and ding-dong-ding. So, but the 52-week, 196 to 294. So tell me, give me some life here. Madam, is Microsoft, is MSFT near its 52-week high or low?
High.
Yes, it is actually very close to its 52-week high. I'm teaching you, if this is interesting to you, you may qualify as weird. No, you may qualify, you may actually have the ability to play this. You've got to like this kind of stuff. It happens in real time. It is just exciting all the time. There's something happening. You're up, you're keyed, 5 o'clock in the morning. If any of you, heaven forbid, come to me and say, I want to be a trader, I'll see to it that we find you the work, and then I'll give you the lecture. Okay, you clean up, you clear your system, you stay frosty. Every day you wake up at 4:30, you say go. You do exercise to get your cardio going. You eat right from now on. You don't play games with the dope and all of that kind of stuff because you have got the chance to trade all that fun off for making a lot of money. And then you can have all the fun you want when you're about 30, 40 years old. Look at the volume. This is OBV, on balance volume. Do you see that the volume is actually not really strong today? Wasn't really strong today. Do you see that? That the volume today was 16.2 million shares. On average, the typical day for the last 52 weeks, it was about 22.3 million shares. So in other words, this was a light trading day on the stock. That can not often, but that would probably explain why the price swing through the day was so small. There really wasn't a lot of activity. It was probably mostly portfolio adjustment. And again, I caution you, I'm saying things that you'll get used to it and it'll begin to make sense to you as time goes on, how, what these, all these things mean. Okay. Beta. It is our measure of risk. Beta is our measure of risk. Beta is our measure of risk. Now, in most disciplines, standard deviation is the measure of risk. Beta measures only part of the risk, the part that you can't get rid of by diversifying your portfolio. You can buy, see that beta there? A beta of 1.00 means that if you put that stock into a well-diversified portfolio, its volatility would move exactly like the world market. 100%, 1.00, is the movement of the world portfolio. If you hold all the stocks of the world, beta of Microsoft is below that. So this is less risky than the world portfolio. In a well-diversified portfolio. If you, sir, were able to buy that stock and you bought just Microsoft, it would be insanely risky. It's a volatile stock. But once you put it into a portfolio, it's noise canceled. A part of the noise, what's called the non-system risk, cancels away. And it turns into a pussycat. 0.78 is actually a low-risk stock. Not super low, but it is what we would call a defensive stock. A defensive stock. Above 1.00, that is an aggressive stock. Now, you form a portfolio. You put stocks into it of similar betas, and out will come a portfolio of that kind of a beta. In this case, Microsoft is a pussycat stock, actually, in a well-diversified portfolio. But I mean, you could take a clock cleaning if you buy Microsoft on its own. It can swing wildly. Think about it like this. Do I have anyone in here who's an arsonist or like an axe murderer? Oh, sure, you're not going to admit it in front of... No, not you. Yeah, you. When you're on your own, you are, I mean, the psychiatric term is crazy mofo, okay? You are dangerous, violent. You listen to grindcore while you're eating potato chips. You even go to sleep listening to Nickelback. Your car is constantly playing dubstep rap. You're crazy, and you're an arsonist. You burn down buildings. You, sir, are a serial killer. You, madam, you eat Cheerios. And I won't go any further, but you see, on your own, you people are scary. Cheerios, really? And you actually put the milk in and then the cereal. I knew someone who did that. The first time I saw it, I said, get out! Leave! But you see, I take you to a party, you're all quiet, you know, you're canceling each other out. You're trying to set things on fire, you're pouring milk on his fires, and you're going around trying to do cereal killing, and she says, no, that's killing the cereal. I like cereal. Do you see how I set that up? I own that one. Okay. But you understand what I'm saying, though, is that in that larger group, there's the calming effect. And this is one of the things about, we see this in insurance. We see it in communities that are well-organized and safe spaces. And we see it in stocks and other investments. The wildness is calmed down so much by the aggregation so that the canceling out effect of the extremes of the behaviors happen. What I'm telling you is this is not some random, you know, belief. This is physics. This is actual physics. And the equations that govern portfolio control theory, they're the same equations that I used to teach years ago when I was teaching physics classes. And it still creeps me out to this day that everything is connected this way. We're not dealing with things that are opinions and ideas and beliefs. We're dealing with science here. Okay, enough of that preaching on that. Now, the PDE ratio, PE ratio, what it is saying, how many dollars are investors willing to pay right now to claim $1 of the company's current earnings? How much are investors willing to pay right now to claim $1 of the company's current earnings? How much are investors willing to pay to claim $1 of the company's current earnings? So in this case, for every dollar that belongs to the shareholders, because the company has earned it for the shareholders, investors are saying, that dollar is going to turn into $36 for us. Actually, about $36.34. That's kind of what it's saying. And don't sweat this too much, because I'll talk about this one over and over again. It's actually technically one of those financial ratios. But think about it that way. You see, this is one of the places where whoever, that one author in the book, I'm not saying that he was off his game, but I'm thinking he was on crack when he said that the higher the PE ratio, the safer the stock. Absolutely opposite. The higher the PE ratio, the more dangerous. As a matter of fact, during one of these extreme periods of time in stock markets, there was one example on the Nikkei of a stock that had a P.E. ratio of 200,000. In other words, investors were paying $200,000 for every dollar the company earned. I mean, you know, call me a little conservative, but they actually thought the company would turn each of its dollars into $200,000. The company essentially just kind of detonated. Where's the breaking point? Actually, in the old days, I would be 36. That's awfully high. Anymore, though, that's actually kind of tame. I look at 30 to 40 as the breaking point for risk. Now, notice that beta is first. But then you look at P.E. ratio for a second, like a second opinion. Okay? It's sort of like, I don't know. You'd ask your mom what you should do, and then you'd ask your dad, but you'd ignore him because he's not as smart as your mom or something like that. I don't know. But the thing of it is that in this case, the P.E. ratio is saying Microsoft is a little riskier than what the betas say. I mean, I look at like 40, 30 to 40 as your breaking point for risk with P.E. ratio. The beta is solidly Microsoft is a safe company, and it is. Microsoft owns the universe. But that P.E. ratio is kind of, there's a lot of money in there. So I would bet, if I were a betting man, that there might be a price drop in Microsoft. Because that P.E. ratio, the price is the numerator. So in order to bring that down to the more intrinsic level of the company, I would see that P.E. ratio sliding backwards, and the way it would do that is through price adjustment downward. And as you can see, Microsoft is near its all-time high right now, or at least its 52-week high. So I see some indicators just hinting that there might be a little bit of room on the downside for Microsoft to slide. I'm going to do this a lot with you. Just talking like this is one of the best ways in the world for you to learn how we think as traders, as investment specialists. And notice, it's not genius. I'm not throwing these insane formulas at you. I'm thinking about basic numbers and how they're constructed and what they tell us about market sentiment. Now, just to go on here a little bit, and I'm going to be a little behind on the lecture today, but I always do this at the beginning. I start getting you into our thinking. And then later, when I run into you out on the quad or maybe at Earl's Cheeseburger Palace and all-night soiree, you know, I can ask you, well, what do you think of finance? And if you say, oh, ew, yeah, I know, you're not, you don't want this, you don't like this. But if you say, I find this interesting, this is kind of cool, then I know that you're maybe someone who can be part of our group. The reality is, and I'll just give you a side point here, finance is traditionally a very sexist field. It is also a very mean field with a lot of dirty players and bad people in it. At the same time, as I told you in the first lecture, one of the things that we need to do is not to take away your driving greed and your fascination with money. I don't want to do that ever. But what I want to do is to get you to the point where you like the numbers, you like the purity of what we do. And yeah, make some money off this and see how the universe turns when it writes its equations and applies them to prices. I'm going to take this off the board, and I'm going to spend a few minutes here telling you about careers in finance, because the problem is that so many people think that finance is all about money and investments. In fact, finance has many aspects to it. One point that I want to make here is that, yeah, investments are a big, big deal in finance. But there are others. In this course, I'm going to give you a lot about corporate finance. Now, this is buying and selling stock investments. Corporate is inside companies, deciding on where to invest company funds, whether to say yes or no to projects. That's always, always important. And that's where it's a quieter world, you make good money. In fact, in this corporate finance, this morning, as I told you, I teach delegations from developing countries. And their interest is in a twist on corporate finance, where they want to say, they say, okay, we want to find a way to get, let's say, $1 billion, and then invest that in small companies so that they grow, and then we can spin them off later, and they're strong companies, and the government has made money off it that it can use to help the people. And the companies are obviously employing more people. They said, how do we know what companies? Their question to me is, how do we know what companies to invest in? And that's where I teach them what I'm going to teach you. I teach them the same thing. The weird thing is that a lot of these people have degrees in finance, but they have them from European and other universities, so they don't have the tools to do the analysis, to look at projects. And so the public finance, in their case, is actually corporate finance. Is this a good company to buy? Is this a good project to invest in? Now, there are other realms, too. Real estate. And I'm not talking about mom and dad's home being on the market. I'm talking about skyscrapers, hotels, strip malls, enclosed malls, field malls, storefronts, anything that's commercial, housing developments, wind turbine fields, communities that have a hydrogen generator or a wind turbine in the center so that they are self-sufficient energy-wise. That's real estate finance. It was actually one of, weirdly enough, it was one of my PhD field specializations, real estate and urban studies. And it's actually, the math isn't too hard, and if you're good at it, you can make a huge amount of money, or instead of making a huge amount of money, you can look like you did and become president. I did not say that. I will so edit that out. Here's one. And this one, I'm not talking about little ponds and lakes and little rivers. I'm talking about oceans of money. Entertainment finance. Movies, TV, series, indies, first line, music and all of its genres, from classical to hip-hop to metal, K-pop, sports. There is it seems like every day there's another stupid sport happening. Not that curling is bad. Curling is not a crime, man. But pickleball is now picking up. Have any of you ever seen High Lie? I mean, High Lie, a ball being thrown at hundreds of miles an hour, it hits a player and the player, you know, just basically detonates. That is so righteous. Okay, wrestling. The fake, the real, it's all there in entertainment. Anything for anybody, 24/7, you don't need to do anything else with your life. You don't even have to live a life because we've got a life for you, whatever you want to do. You want fantasy, you want adventure, you want romance, you want murder, anything you want, we've got for you, and you will pay for it because we've got you hooked. That's the best thing in the world, is when you can sell a product that everyone is addicted to. Entertainment is that, and it's finance. How do we fund it? How do we channel the money? How do we get the talent? How do we get put together the operation? How do we move from one venue to the next? How do we set up production? Where do we get the capital to do this stuff? It's all there. Entertainment finance is just awesome. One of the last field trips I did was with my club. I took them up to, I think it's called U.S. Cellular at the time it was, the Sox, White Sox. And I mean, just, I took them to the finance people, and then I took them down to Joliet, to the racing center down there. It's money. It's investment. It's deciding what's next on the agenda. We had one of the drivers was explaining the financial logic of what he does with all the stuff all over him, the advertisements, and talking about how he has to financially plan for the day that he hits that gas on the green light and he goes blind, because every time he does that acceleration, his retinas are slowly tearing away. So we've got to make sure that he's taken care of. And of course, we've got to make sure that the next round of idiots who are going to drag down that strip for 3.5 seconds and burn up $250,000 are there to do it. And that means we've got to get butts in the seat. How do we do that? Well, it was always easier when we had a bunch of drunk, tweaking meth heads listening to it. Now we've got to get kids involved in it. So we can't have the crazies there, because we've got to get a new generation into those seats. That means, what do we have to do to value the per seat, butt in the seat, per butt in the seat? Okay, that's going to be about $7. Okay, how many of those to finance this and make a good profit to make it worth our risk in this? That's all part of just one simple thing. The talent is everything, and making people believe that there's talent even when there's not so much. That's entertainment finance. It is quite an awesome thing. I'm trying to get a course started here, and no one wants, I don't think that's really all that interesting. Oh, God, you don't know, man. Anyway, that's what I can offer you. Even if you don't major in finance or minor, you can at least appreciate that this is a decent thing to learn for at least one semester from the greatest professor who ever lived. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.